and this extraordinary opportunity that we have, because it's so difficult to have this kind of life. We take it very much for granted, but having a healthy body, a healthy mind, and especially interest in the Dharma and the opportunity to encounter Dharma teachers and teachings and communities. It's very difficult, very rare actually, to have this. So while we have the opportunity, while we can progress along the path and free ourselves from the misery of cyclic existence, then we should definitely do that. And what's more, realizing that all beings are caught in cyclic existence, should open our heart to them, seeing that they're just like us, wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, and therefore aspire for full Buddhahood, so we'll have the compassion, wisdom, and power to really be able to be of the greatest benefit. So cultivate that motivation and have a joyful mind, really appreciating your opportunity to listen to the teachings. Okay, so we're going to be continuing on this text by the third Dalai Lama called The Essence of Refined Gold. And we're at the section right now that's called Training the Mind in the Path Common to the Person of Intermediate Capacity. So we completed the path of the beings who of initial capacity. And so initial level, I think, is better. So these are people who aspire to have a peaceful death and a good rebirth. And so because they want to have a good rebirth, they take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha and then follow karma and its effects, and in particular try to abandon the 10 negative actions. Okay, remember those? Actually the 10 non-virtues, I should say. Try to abandon those, try to create good karma that will ripen in a good rebirth. Okay, so this is the third Dalai Lama is assuming that we're somewhat familiar with that path. So if we've been listening to teachings and contemplating them, then maybe we are. Depends how much we slept in our meditation. But now we're going on to training the mind in common with the person of the intermediate, who's on the intermediate level. And why it says the person in common, why we're training on the path in common with the intermediate level person, is because we are actually aspiring for full enlightenment, but in order to get to full enlightenment, we have to practice the path from the beginning. And so we have to practice the path that we share in common with the initial level person, and now the path in common with the intermediate level person. Okay? But we're trying to actually get to full enlightenment. So that's why we're practicing it in common with them, because we don't want to just stop at the practices that are done by the initial level practitioner or the medium level practitioner. Okay? So the person of the intermediate level, they contemplate the Four Noble Truths. So thinking about the truth of dukkha, sometimes translated as suffering or unsatisfactory conditions, the origin of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha and its origins, and the path leading to that cessation. So that's the principal topic of the intermediate level practitioner. And it's really quite, there's a lot of material in here. When you start going into the Four Noble Truths, there's a lot of things to understand. So the third Dalai Lama in this section, he actually spent a lot of time on the first noble truth, the truth of dukkha, And then he went through the path very quickly. Okay, the last noble truth very quickly. But I think that we're going to kind of spend a little bit more time on the origin and on the cessation as well. Okay, because I think it's very, very helpful to understand the Four Noble Truths. This is a basic teaching that is shared in common by all Buddhist traditions. And if you understand the Four Noble Truths, then you will understand where different teachings go. When you listen to them, you'll understand, you know, are they teachings falling in, talking about the truth of dukkha or the cause of dukkha or what's going on here. So it's a very good framework to have. And also the teaching on the Four Noble Truths was the first teaching that the Buddha gave after he was enlightened. And it really outlined his entire teaching. So it's quite an important thing. The reason it's called the Four Noble Truths, okay, because we say, well, the four truths, well, one of them is dukkha or suffering. How is suffering noble? Okay, well, no, the noble there doesn't modify the suffering. Suffering is not noble. What a more accurate translation would be is four facts seen as true by the noble ones. And noble ones refers to Aryas, those beings who have direct realization of emptiness. So these are the Sangha jewel, you know, in our refuge, the people that we can trust because they've actually seen the ultimate nature of reality. And they have seen that these four facts are true. Okay, they aren't made up. Now, the first one, we start out talking about dukkha and its suffering, and just or what's often translated as suffering, but that's not a very, suffering is not a very good translation, because when we hear suffering, we think of ouch and pain, and then, you know, we say, well, I'm fine, my life is good, I'm not suffering. But, you know, when we understand that dukkha doesn't mean just suffering, it means unsatisfactory, then even when we're happy, we can still acknowledge that things are unsatisfactory, aren't they? Yeah, because whatever we're happy, it doesn't last for long. It isn't permanent. Okay? So, you know, we're going to go through these and talk about them. And like I said, the third Dalai Lama goes into great depth about dukkha, and especially the dukkha of living in the human realm. And we might wonder, why in the world does he talk so much about this? He talks about birth and aging and sickness and death and on and on. He lists all the aggravation you go through when you get old, and I'm in the process of aging, and I would really like not to have to hear about this. Okay, so why does he talk so much about it? It only makes me depressed. I did not come to Buddhism to get depressed. Well, that's very true. None of us came to the Dharma to get depressed. We can create that mental state all by ourselves. We don't need any teachings on how to do it. So the reason that the Buddha talked about all of this is to help us see our situation more clearly. The idea being that when you see your situation clearly, then you get some energy to do something about it. Whereas when we're whitewashing everything, then it just seems like we're in la-la land. And then when aging, sickness, and death hit, we're totally left without any tools. Okay? Whereas if we think about these things, then we can help use them to motivate ourselves to really practice the path that leads to the end of suffering and the causes of suffering. Okay? So that's why the Buddha teaches it. And it's important to understand this. Otherwise, we just want to close our ears and read, you know, I don't know, Family Circle magazine where everything looks good. Yeah? Okay, so let's go to the text and see what the third Dalai Lama says. So he starts out by saying, although by avoiding the 10 non-virtues and practicing their opposites, the 10 virtues, you can attain a special rebirth in the higher realms, you will not pass beyond the frustrations of cyclic existence. For this reason, seek to attain nirvana, liberation beyond all misery and pain. Okay, so when he's talking about, you know, avoiding the 10 non-virtues and practicing the 10 virtues, then he's referring back to the previous meditation on the law of karma and its effects, you know, and that we want to do that so as to prevent a bad rebirth and create the causes for a good rebirth, because that's the most urgent thing we need to do. Okay? Now, some people may say, well, it's not so urgent, you know. I'm only 21. My rebirth is a long time away. Well, do you have any guarantee it's not going to start tonight? You know? I mean, we all feel, hey, you know, I'm young and I'm going to live for a long time. And we have absolutely no idea when we're going to die and no control over it. Yeah? And, I mean, even when you age, your definition of aging, of old, changes every year. You know, I mean, I remember when I thought 40 was like with the dinosaurs, and now it's like really young, you know? So you never feel like you're old and approaching death. So, you know, this is why we need to think about these things quite realistically, because we don't know when death is going to be right in front of us. Okay? So we abandon non-virtues and practice virtue, so that we can have a good rebirth. And we want a good rebirth, not just so that we can avoid the suffering of the lower realms, but because in order to attain full enlightenment, we need a series of good rebirths, because we need the opportunity to be able to continue practicing the Dharma. You know, although they say we can attain enlightenment in one lifetime, they also say don't plan on it. Okay, and so we should also make preparations for having a good future rebirth so that we can continue practicing. Okay, but then, you know, when we aspire for a good future rebirth, that motivation is still limited because we're still seeking rebirth in cyclic existence. I mean, it sure beats a bad rebirth, but it's still rebirth in cyclic existence. And so in order to aspire for actual freedom, for nirvana, let alone for full enlightenment, we need to see the defects of rebirth anywhere in cyclic existence. Okay? And so that's why now the third Dalai Lama is going to really start talking about the various miseries in the realms of cyclic existence, so that we get a very strong impetus to free ourselves from it. So the analogy is often given, you know, cyclic existence is said to be like being in prison. Okay? Now, if you're in prison and, you know, you don't know anything else, then you say, well, you know, prison is kind of good. You know, I have these beautiful bars, and the, you know, the handcuffs aren't as bad as they could be, and the cinder block walls, well, they're kind of interesting, and concrete floors are not too bad, and why should I try and get out of prison? You know, I get 3 hots and a cot here, you know, so I'll just kind of hang out in prison for a while, not too bad. Okay, but if you really see the defects of being in prison, then you don't want to be there. And then, you know, you really do everything you can to get out. So the same way, the same thing is with cyclic existence, you know. If we see cyclic existence as, well, it's kind of nice. I mean, beautiful trees at the Abbey, good food, nice people. The bed could use a little improving, but it's not so bad. You know, then why, you know, kind of samsara is nice. And then we have no impetus, no energy to get out, and so we just keep wallowing in the same kind of stupidaggio. It's a good Italian word that describes the situation. Just doing stupid things again and again, thinking that they're bringing us happiness. Okay, so we really have to see what cyclic existence entails, so we'll want to be free of it. So the third Dalai Lama says, what is the nature of the shortcomings of cyclic existence? Those of the lower realms have been explained above. Meditate upon them well, for when you have done so, you will realize that you would not enjoy such long and intense misery, and you will automatically generate an intention to work by any possible means to remain free of such unsatisfactory modes of existence. Okay, so if we spent some time contemplating the three lower realms as he described it in the beginning part, then we will definitely aspire not to be born there. Okay, so just to review, there's being born as an animal where you're so much under the influence of ignorance and other living beings control you or eat you or whatever, use you for beasts of burden. Or being born in the hungry ghost realm where the beings have such incredible frustration and dissatisfaction not being able to get food and drink. And then being born in the hellish realms where there's incredible physical and mental torture. And so when we really think about it, then, you know, it's like, well, I don't want to be born there. And so that leads us to follow the law of karma and its effect. Okay. But then, the third Dalai Lama says, however, even the higher realms are not beyond the reaches of suffering, and to progress along the path, you must eventually face this truth. So we may generate the intention not to be born in the lower realm, but then we look at the higher realms, and they seem kind of nice, yeah, but as long as we see them as nice, then we don't see their defects, and so we don't really face the truth about them. Okay, so we have to look at the defects of our human life, and then we also have to look at the defects of the form and formless realms, where we, you know, you take birth in them by the power of your samadhi. Okay, and those are apparently very blissful realms, but you're also stuck in cyclic existence. Okay, so he begins talking about the defects of the human realm. So he says, human beings, for example, are wrapped in suffering. While in the womb, they suffer from darkness, constriction, and immersion in filthy substances. When, during the last months of the mother's pregnancy, the downward pushing winds come, the unborn baby feels like a small piece of wood crushed in a giant vise, or like a sesame seed pounded for its oil. After he or she emerges from the womb, he feels as though he fell into a pit of thorns, even if he was wrapped in soft garments and placed in a feathery bed. Such is the agony of birth. Okay. Now, I remember when my teachers talked about this at one of the first meditation courses I have. You know, what it's like to be a baby in the womb, and how, you know, you're kind of trapped. You don't have much room. You don't have much wiggle room in the womb, do you? You know, and it's kind of dark and it's cramped and you're surrounded by all this gook. And then when you're getting born, you know, the uterus starts to contract and, you know, you have no idea what in the world's going on, and you're just being pushed and pushed through this small, narrow place, and then some doctor grabs your head with, you know, a pair of tongs and pulls you out and whacks you on the bottom and says, welcome to the world, and puts these drops in your eyes, and then, you know, even you're placed on a bed or given to your mother, your skin isn't used to any kind of outside contact, and so it all just feels very unfamiliar and rough and uncomfortable and scary, you know, because you've never felt these sensations before, you've never heard all these sounds before, you've never smelled the things that you're smelling, you know, and you have no conceptual framework for understanding your experience, you know, and you're completely dependent upon others to take care of you. You know, I mean, if you're hungry, if you're cold, if you're hot, if you're uncomfortable, forget it. You can't do anything to take care of yourself. You know, other people are, you know, completely take care of you. So, you know, I remember when my teachers were talking about this, and then, you know, some people in the class raised their hands and said, but the psychologists all tell us that the womb is nice and comfy and we all go into fetal position because we want to return there because it's so secure. You know, what are you guys talking about? Okay, so here we had, you know, a cultural clash. Yeah. So, you know, I can't remember being in the womb, so I can't tell you what it was really like. But I can imagine it being kind of cramped and uncomfortable and not knowing what in the world was going on. And not being able to speak up for yourself and say what you needed or get anything for yourself while you're in the womb or while you're being born or while you're an infant. You know, I can imagine that. So, you know, if people say it's a nice, warm, comfy place that we all want to go back to, I'm not sure that we'd fit. But, you know, I don't know where that idea comes from. Unless it's kind of our glorification of you know, part of our life. In any case, you know, just think about it. If you were who you are now and you went back to the womb in an effort to be secure, would you be comfortable there? Yeah, you know, even if your poor mother was, you know, could fit you in, you would be pretty cramped, and I don't think we'd really be very happy there. Okay, so that's something, you know, it's a kind of suffering that you go through to be born as a human being. And, you know, from the side of the mother, they call it labor for a reason. Yeah, it isn't called hunky-dory going to the movies having a happy time. It's called labor, you know, and if you've ever been in labor, seen somebody in labor, it is labor, you know, and it's very hard to have a child, and there's an incredible amount of pain, physical pain involved. My mother said that, because I was the oldest, and she said that it's good that she forgot how bad it hurt. Otherwise, she wouldn't have had my brother. Yeah. You know, that's what it's like. So, you know, we have to see if this is something that we want to glorify and continue to have, or if it's something that, you know, seeing how it really is, that we think it's better to relinquish all rebirth in samsara, including in the human realm. Okay, the baby grows into a youth, and soon he is old. Okay, so that covered a lot of years in there. Okay, think of what you went through, okay, as an infant, and what you went through as a toddler, and what you went through as a child in grammar school, and then middle school, and then high school, okay. Think of what you went through going through adolescence. Okay? Do you want to be 12 and 13 again? Do you want to go through that again? Yeah? I mean, think about what you were like when you were an adolescent. Now, I don't know about you, you know, but my hormones were going completely bonkers off the wall. You know, my mind was like a roller coaster at Disneyland. I mean, ecstatic one moment and sobbing the next. you know, I thought I was the center of the universe and that the universe was totally wrong in not recognizing me as such. And, you know, I was totally discontent with everything. And do you remember what your mind was like as an adolescent? How you wanted everybody to like you? And how you hung out with all your friends, you know, talking about how to get other people to like you? And how when other people liked you, then you were proud and arrogant. And then, but we always were fearful of being the kids that other people picked on. And sometimes we were the kids that other people picked on. Yeah? You remember all of that? Okay, do you want to go through that again? Okay, so, you know, if you really think about the different stages in our life, I mean, the passages we go through and the you know, the physical and psychological challenges that we have, it's not always easy, yeah? I mean, when I was in adolescence, I thought adolescence was terrific. It was so exciting. You know, I had more freedom. And, you know, it's like now looking back on adolescence, it's like, oh my God. You know, 101 ways to make yourself miserable by the way you think. Okay? Anybody else like that? Yeah, we should tell stories sometime, right? Yeah. Of what we were like as adolescents. Yeah? What we did. A few of you look a bit nervous. Okay. So, a baby grows into a youth and soon he is old. His back bends like a bow. His hair turns white as a dried flower. And his forehead fills with wrinkles until he looks like a strip of sliced leather. Okay, now you're not going to sell many magazines to 40 plus women with this kind of description. Unless, of course, you have the solution being Botox or, you know, some kind of wrinkle cream or, you know, dye your hair or... you know, now for it's the guys, you know, the guys have to dye their hair now too. You know, you get a little bit gray around the temples, that's not so good. Nobody's going to love you. Okay, so, but if we look at it, this is exactly what's happening to our body, isn't it? It is getting older, yeah, and we are getting more wrinkles, we are getting more gray hair. Okay, we are sagging in places that we do not want to sag. Okay, we bulge in places where we don't want to bulge. We don't bulge in places where we want to bulge. Okay, the body is essentially disintegrating. Okay, and the more we hold on to this concept of youth and beauty, the more difficult it is to grow old. And you can see some people, I mean, growing old is torture for them, you know? Like the guys who are very strong and really into sports and athletic and, you know, the kind of macho He-Man type that, you know, always knocking some little ball here or there, thinking it's a big thing. you know, then when they start to lose their power, then it's like... what can I do? I can't throw a football anymore, you know. Maybe I'll play golf, but, you know, after a while it gets to be miniature golf. You can't even hit the golf ball very far. Yeah. And then it's, you know, you're just a couch potato watching all the sports things on Saturday afternoon. Okay. And so growing old is such torture because there's so much attachment to this idea of being young and strong and athletic, you know. And then your back goes out and, you know, you can't even carry a suitcase and a woman can carry the suitcase better than you, you know. And all this stuff happens and, you know, so you're going kind of nuts. And then for the women, you know, it's like we've been taught since day one that you're only valuable if you're a sex object. And, you know, I mean, definitely you're getting older and uglier, you know. And so then you have to get all these creams and take all this stuff and, you know, try and pretend you're still 20. And, of course, the guys are starting to pretend that they're still 20, too. That's why we get these ridiculous junk mails for Viagra, you know, because everybody's in total denial about getting old and trying to pretend they're 20 even though they just got out of the horror of adolescence. Okay, so, I mean, if this isn't craziness in our society, it's, you know, it's totally nuts. But when we're very attached to youth, then this process of growing old is just terrible, you know. And it's like they say that it's a good thing that we grow old gradually, because if we looked in the mirror, like, all of a sudden, you know, and we were 30 years older than we were last time, that we would faint in horror. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't make much sense. But then, you know how sometimes when you look at your old pictures and your scrapbooks, and there you were when you were 20, and you look in the mirror, and, well, it is good, it happened gradually. You know, because I don't look anything like I looked like when I was 20. You know, and I think it's a very interesting thing, you know, to do this with people. Look at young people and imagine what they're going to look like when they're old. And when you look at old people, imagine what they looked like when they were young. Sometimes it's really hard. You know, think of your grandparents. Do you have any idea what they could have looked like when they were 20? You know? No, you know, grandparents came out of the womb with gray hair and wrinkles. You know, that's how we look at it. We can't ever imagine them having been young, but they were one time. And somebody even considered them sexy. Can you imagine? Okay? And so this is the same thing about us. You know, we're going to look like that one time. And so people are going to look at us and go, people once thought you were sexy? You know? Oh. Okay? So, you know, it's when you're attached to youth, then aging is very difficult. And so that's why, you know, our society is in such denial about it, and we go to such extremes trying to pretend that we're not getting old. Okay, so we dye our hair, yeah, or we cut it off. Okay, that's not the reason I shave my head, but it is a perk. Nobody knows how gray my hair is. Okay, you know, you use Botox, you use anti-wrinkle cream, you do neck exercises so your neck doesn't sag, you go to the gym, you do all sorts of things, but, you know, the body's basically getting older and weaker and less attractive, and that's been happening since we were born. Okay? So I think, you know, when we can accept this as reality, then we can think, well, what kind of old person do I want to be? And what is really going to be a benefit to me when I'm old? Yeah. Because good looks are not going to benefit us when we're old, because we're not going to have them. Strength isn't going to be greatly beneficial, because we're not going to have that either. What's going to really help us when we're old? Yeah? Okay, we might think, oh, if I had a lot of money, that'll help us when we're old. But no, you know, you might have a fancier wheelchair than somebody who's poor, but, you know, that's not a big consolation. You know, it's really the state of our mind that helps us when we're old, isn't it? You know, and we see people who age gracefully and who are happy as senior citizens, and we see people who do not age gracefully and are bitter and angry and depressed. Okay? And so we should look and, you know, see what they're like, and then think, who do I want to be like? Because whatever I'm doing now is creating cause to be either the person who is happy and relaxed being old, or the person who's bitter and angry and depressed. So which am I creating the cause to be like? And that's all depending on our mind and what we're attached to. So it's important to think about that. Okay. So he goes on describing what it's like to be old. Sitting down is like dropping a heavy load, and standing up is like uprooting a tree. True or not true? Yeah? When you see old people sit down? Well, forget old people. When you sit down when you're tired, is it like dropping a heavy load? It is. We go plonk into the chair. Pulling yourself up, is it like uprooting a tree? Yup. You know? And we don't even consider ourselves old right now. Okay. If he tries to speak, his tongue will not obey. And if he tries to walk, he staggers. When you see people who are old, this is what happens, isn't it? You know, you try and speak, the words don't come out. You try and walk, the steps are uneven. You shuffle along. Yeah. His sensory powers, such as sight and hearing, begin to fail him. Okay. Can't hear as well. Some of us are noticing that already. Can't see as well. So you have these ridiculous glasses, you know, and the sensory, you know, the senses are failing. Yeah, his body loses luster and resembles a corpse. It's true, isn't it? You know, sometimes when you're quite old, yeah, and I mean, it's very interesting. Some people, when they age, they put on a lot of weight. And they just look like kind of these masses of jello. And then some people, when they get very old, are very thin, and they basically look like a corpse, you know, with skin on it, like a skeleton with skin on it. Okay. His memory degenerates, and he can remember nothing. We're getting there, aren't we? Okay, how many of us get in our 40s and 50s and... You walk in a room, and why did I walk in that room? What was I going to get? Yeah? Or you sit down, and you're going to say something, and you open your mouth, and... you forgot. Yeah? And short-term memory is not so good anymore. You know, we can remember all the commercial jingos from when we were 5 years old, but we can't remember... something we read this morning. So the you know, faculties start to fail, and the mind also starts to fail. You know, now that people's bodies are living longer, then you know there's the fear of Alzheimer's or dementia. You know? And we always look at our grandparents or now our parents, and we think, oh, that's not going to happen to me. But, you know, they once were young like us, and it happened to them. You know, being disoriented. Yeah, you wander off and you don't know where you are. Yeah. Or you're in a place. I remember going to visit my grandma, and all the old people. It's like, you know how high chairs had a table in front of them, the high chairs that you have when a baby? Well, that's what all the old people had in front of them, because that was like keeping them from falling over. Yeah, you know, kind of. And then, you know, sitting there and drooling and, you know, having no idea kind of who they are, where they are, what's going on. You know, using things for things they aren't appropriate with. You know, you get Alzheimer's, and then all of a sudden you have 7 pairs of pants on. Yeah? Or you put chapstick on your toothbrush. Okay? So, you know, who knows? It might not be too long before we're doing that. And then, you know, what in the world are people going to think about us? Yeah, I talked to one Dharma friend of mine, and he was maybe in his 50s when this happened, but he couldn't find his address book, and he looked all over for it. And then he gave up because he couldn't find it, and then he went to the refrigerator to get something to eat, and his address book was in the refrigerator. And he's going, how did it get here? You know, there was nobody else in this house. So that gets kind of scary, you know, you start to lose your mental faculties. So, you know, the point is here that if we keep taking rebirth and cyclic existence in the human realm, then we keep experiencing this kind of aging again and again and again and again. That's the point here. Yeah. So having a good rebirth is certainly better than a bad one, and it's something we want to practice the Dharma, but we don't want to be satisfied with that, because if we're satisfied with it, then we're just going to have to keep on going through this aging process again and again. So we want to generate the aspiration for liberation. The Dalai Lama continues talking about aging. The powers of digestion fail, and he can no longer eat properly, no matter how much he craves food. Yeah, so your teeth fall out. Yeah, you can't eat properly, your stomach gets upset by everything. At this point, his life is almost finished, and death is rapidly approaching. Such are the sufferings of aging. So this is what we have in front of us if we live that long. So the question is, you know, there's a few questions. One is, do we want to continue being born in a life where we get old? Well, no, we want to aspire for liberation. Okay, but considering in this life we are in that situation, and if we live so long that we're going to become old like that, how are we going to prepare for it? What do we want to do now to, in order to prepare our mind to handle what we're going to have to face when we're old? You know, so okay, we want to keep our bodies healthy and, you know, kind of watch our weight and get exercise and things like that, but that alone won't guarantee us happiness in old age. Yeah, so what are we going to do to be happy? Well, what causes suffering when we're in old age? Now you're going to say, well, the body causes suffering. But it's not, you know, okay, the body gets uncomfortable, but it's more the attachment to youth that causes a lot of suffering. I mean, there's the physical pain of the body, but what is worse, the physical pain of the body or the mental pain of fear of getting sick? Or the mental pain of fear of being rejected and left behind because you're old? You know, because our society really, you know, neglects old people. So, you know, have you ever been thought about being put in an old age home? You know, what are you going to do when you're in an old age home? Yeah, what are you going to do with your mind? Are you going to sit there and watch TV all the time? Yeah, what are you going to do? So, you know, we have to ask ourselves, and I think start creating the mental habits now so that we can become the kind of old person like we want to be. You know, now, okay, let's say our karma is such that we're in an old folks home, and everybody around is kind of, you know, fallen apart. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to be a happy, loving, kind old person? Yeah? So that even if your own body's falling apart, you can still smile at the other people around you and say kind words to you, say kind words to them. And wouldn't it be nice so that when the nurses and the PTs and the OTs and other people come to take care of you, that you're happy and friendly and you're not a drag to be with? You know? So how are we going to have a happy mind when our body isn't cooperating? By practicing right now. Yeah? And cultivating a happy mind right now. And so whenever our body is the least bit uncomfortable right now, practicing having a happy mind and a kind mind with the slight discomfort we feel now, so that when we're old and it's major discomfort, we'll have some practice and we won't get wigged out by, you know, what's going on with the body when we're old. Okay, making some sense? Yeah? And so the same thing, you know, if we want to be a kind old person, you know, and bring some joy to the staff and the other people in our old folks home, or even if you think your kids are going to take care of you, you know, trying to be a nice old person so that your kids want to take care of you. You know, or if you don't have kids, so that, you know, anybody, you know, you'll take what you can get in terms of people taking care of you when you're old, so that they're going to want to. Yeah, so that you're not just one of these old people who's going, yeah, this is wrong, that's wrong, you aren't doing this for me, and you aren't doing that for me, you know. And to look, and, you know, some of us behave like that right now, don't we? You know, and forget about being old. We are the biggest whiners in the world now. You know, whenever we don't get what we want, I don't like this. I want this food. I don't want that food. I don't like this chair. I want that chair. You know, it's like we're just so complaining and whining. So if we do that now when we're young, what are we going to be like when we're old? Yeah? I mean, we're going to be even more miserable. And then the hard part about being as old is we're going to really need other people's help, but we're going to be so disagreeable to be with that they're not going to want to help us. Yeah? So I think it's, you know, we need to start thinking about this now, and, you know, at least if we care about ourselves, try and become an agreeable person now, you know, so that we can set that habit in our mind to be an agreeable older person. Okay, Third Dalai Lama continues. As well as the sufferings of birth and age, throughout life we must continually confront the sufferings of illness. When the elements of our body fall out of harmony, our skin dries and our flesh sags. Food and drink, usually so appealing, seem repulsive, and instead we must ingest bitter medicines and undergo unpleasant treatments, like operations, moxibustion, acupuncture, and so forth. Okay? So sickness is part of having this body, isn't it? We've all been sick before. We know that if we live long, we're going to be sick again. There's no way out. So then the question again is, how am I going to be a happy sick person? We may be healthy now, but we know that if we live long, we're going to get sick. Yeah. So how are we going to make our mind happy when we're sick? Yeah. We have to learn to make our mind happy now. We have to learn to let go of, you know, being so reactive to having an uncomfortable, aching body. You know, we have to learn to let's say, do the meditation on taking and giving. Yeah, so that we can make the discomfort of having a sick and ailing body, you know, so that we can transform it into something that creates merit and creates virtue. Okay? And we have to think more of how to have a happy mind and lessen the attachment to our body. You know, because attachment to our body just makes us so miserable. Doesn't it? Yeah? And yet we're all incredibly attached to this body. And what is it? You know, what is this body we're so attached to? If you take the skin off, is this body anything beautiful? You know, it's muscles and bones and intestines and kidneys and lungs, and it's nothing gorgeous. And yet we are so attached to this thing. You know, and we pamper it so much. So that mental attachment to the body, you know, causes so much mental suffering. Now and especially as the body ages and when the body gets sick. Yeah, the more attached we are, the more we suffer. Okay, should the disease be incurable, says the Dalai Lama, we experience immeasurable suffering from fear, worry, and apprehension. And if the disease is fatal, we live with death in front of our eyes. So it's true. If we have an incurable disease, then our mind is just paralyzed with fear. You know, it's like we're afraid of suffering. We're afraid of the disease getting worse. We're afraid of dying from it. Okay, we don't want to suffer, so the mind is just tortured by fear and worry and anxiety and apprehension. And You know, if the disease is terminal and we're actively dying, then we have all the fear that comes from actually facing death. Yeah. So this is our future. I mean, again, if we live long enough, you know, this is what's going to happen. Either our body's going to fall apart, and you know, and we have an incurable disease, and we have to deal with all of that. Or, you know, it's time to die, and then we have to deal with that. So again, the question comes, well, a few questions. One is, you know, do I want to continue being born in samsara, where this experience keeps coming again and again? Yeah. And so seeing that, say no, I want to attain liberation, I want to attain nirvana. Okay. And then when we look at other sentient beings, seeing that they're stuck in the same way, then thinking I want to help them attain liberation and enlightenment. Okay? But then also the other question is, well, how am I going to train my mind now so that when this happens, I can be happy during it? Because for sure, aging and death and sickness are going to happen unless we die in the very next moment, in which case death happens only. But, you know, for sure, death is going to happen. There's no way around that one. Okay, so how do we want to die? Okay, so for somebody who hasn't prepared, then the Dalai Lama describes this. Thoughts of evil we created during our lifetime cause our heart to fill with regret, and we recollect all that we have left undone. We understand that we soon must leave our body, friends, relatives, associates, and possessions. Our mouth dries, our lips shrivel, our nose sinks, our eyes fade, and our breath passes in gasps. Tremendous fear of the lower realms arises within us, and although we do not wish it, we die. So if we've been with people who have died, you know, when they're actively dying, we can see this happening in them. Yeah. Sometimes their body is immobilized. You know, we can't see it through their outward expressions, but, you know, we don't know exactly what's going on in their mind, but occasionally a facial expression happens in their mind and we have some idea, you know. So why does this fear of death come? It, you know, at the time when we're actively dying, it comes because we have so many regrets about the way we lived, okay? So what kind of things do we regret from how we lived? Okay. Now, we spend a lot of time when we're young working long hours, okay, to climb up the corporate ladder, to get a lot of money so we can have fame and power and we can do whatever we want and we can be really free if we have a lot of money. And so we work overtime. And when we die, have you ever heard of anybody dying with the regret that they didn't work enough overtime? You know, nobody dies that way. Yet we will spend our life, you know, as workaholics, running around, you know, trying to do all this work. For what purpose, you know? Well, to get money. Well, for what purpose? Yeah. So, you know, it's something to think about. And then, you know, if we look back on our life right now, like if we were to die tonight and we look back on our life, are there things that we regret having done in our life? And if there are, then it's good to do some purification practice now instead of waiting until the time when we're actively dying. You know, do the purification practice now so that if there are things that we've regretted, that we've done, that we regret in our life, we can heal them emotionally inside and put them down and leave them instead of these things kind of always plaguing us while we're alive and then coming to really torment us as the fear of regret or as fears and regrets at the time we die. So, you know, if we really keep on top of our life and continually do the four opponent powers, then when we go to bed at night, our conscience is clear, our mind is clear, we feel at peace with the world because we've purified what we need to purify. You know, if we had a negative attitude, we've, you know, let it go, we know what the antidote is to you know, handle it, and we've applied that. And so then when we go to bed at night, there's no fear and anxiety. Yeah, there's no bad mood. And if we keep on top of our life like this, then when it comes time to die, then it's the same thing, you know, it's like, well, I'm already on top of everything in my life. I don't have a lot of fears. I don't have a lot of regrets. Yeah. And I remember one, you know, I won't tell that story, but, you know, I think it's really important that if there are things we need to say to people, like if there are people we need to apologize to, we should do it now. You know, don't think, well, I'm going to wait until they're dying to apologize, because they may die before you can apologize. Or you may die before you can apologize. You know? And if there's people that you're harboring a lot of animosity towards and resentment and grudges, then similarly, you know, try and work with your mind and let go of that now. Because, you know, death may come very quickly and you may not be able to let go of it later on. You know, and so we want to really make sure that we're able to let go of any kind of animosity and grudges we may have in our life. You know, and if we can do that now, then the rest of our days are free from the suffering of grudges. And then when death comes, you know, the mind's okay. So if you have very conflicted feelings about somebody in your life, it's really good, you know, now when you can, to practice the antidotes to those conflicted feelings. You know, so if there's a lot of anger and you're conflicted because of that, then, you know, take out, you know, Santideva's book, Chapter 6, or take out Working with Anger and do all those meditations, you know, to let go of the anger. Or if you have this love-hate relationship and, you know, one part of your mind is still stuck to somebody and craving to be with them and missing them and longing them, you know, then do the meditations on impermanence right now so that you can let go and, you know, see that relationship and that person. You know, neither one of them are permanent, so there's no use being attached and holding on to those things. So if we do those kinds of meditations now, then our mind can be at peace with the people around us. And then when death comes, you know, it's just like, okay, bye-bye. You know, on to the next adventure. And there's no fear, there's no regret, there's no remorse. Yeah. And we're able just to let go and be very peaceful when we die. Yeah. And if you, you know, had the fortune to see some people who are Dharma practitioners, when they die, this is kind of like how they die. It's just, you know, it's like, okay, this is what I'm doing today. You know, one of my teachers, he died on there's one of the four great days in the Buddhist calendar called Lobok Dukchen. It's the anniversary of the day that the Buddha descended from one of the heavens after teaching his mother. And so one of my teachers, he woke up that morning. This was in what year? 1984. And he woke up to that morning and, you know, said to his attendant, "Oh, please make sure you take care of this and this and this and this and this." Went in his room to do his morning meditation and died. You know, and I'm sure he did it all quite consciously and aware and knew he was going to die. And similarly, in another one of my teachers, when he was way up in the mountains in the Spiti Lahul area, then he was staying at someone's home and he told his attendant before he went to bed, he said, "I don't feel so well, you know, make sure you do this and this and this and this." And he went and he laid down and then he died, and they later, when his attendant came in, he had his hands in front of his heart, you know, like this, cross, like you hold the Dorjean bell. You know, and so I think he too also was, you know, quite aware the time of death came, just, you know, die, you know, no problem, no sweat, no dismay, and just did it. Yeah? And so if we practice well, then when the time of death comes, then we can be like that too. Yeah? But to be able to die with kind of grace and without it, you know, all this clinging and fear and attachment and stuff, then we have to start releasing the attachment now. Yeah, and we have to start looking at the things we're afraid of and releasing them now. Okay, so that's as far as we got this time. We will continue with it. If you have questions, you can mail them to office@travasti.org, and then I'll speak to them on next Thursday. Okay, so those of you who are meditating afterwards, imagine yourself as an old person. Imagine yourself as a sick person. See, you know, ask yourself, how am I going to be when I'm like that? What kind of things do I need to cultivate now so that I can be like that in a graceful way? And then also use that as impetus to develop renunciation for all of samsara and aspire for the bliss of liberation. Those of you who are just having a discussion group after this, then, you know, go through these same points and talk about your experiences in seeing people get old and sick and die, and what is it like, and what have you learned from those experiences. Okay, so let's dedicate.